For a penny and for
Hello and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Arvind Rajagopal. I teach media studies at New York University.
And Arvind, you're one of my oldest friends, but I haven't seen you for a long time, and I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for agreeing to do this. It means a lot in the context of decades of friendship and even love. So thank you.
Honored to be part of your podcast, Toby. Thank you for including me.
And Arvind, I'd like to start by asking you what is currently dynamizing, retarding, interesting, concerning, preoccupying you.
Right. Yes. So let me say a little bit about my training is as a sociologist, before which I had a degree in electrical engineering. As with almost everyone I knew in my school, electrical or mechanical or civil, but I chose electrical. And so I wended my way through the university with a and got out with a PhD in sociology. And by the time I came out, there wasn't much of a market for sociologists that worked on non-Western parts of the world. Especially those who favored qualitative methodologies and post-colonial theories and so forth. So I found myself in the media studies department. And so there I continue to reside, and media studies has been a less policed space. Perhaps you'd agree, Toby, that's
Well
have a
put.
long conversation on that subject, yeah, or differently policed, but at any rate, yes. So, what currently occupies me is the history of the discipline itself, and its seeming difficulty in acknowledging its own international past and its implication in projects of internationalism undertaken by, let's say, the United States, and the place of media within those international projects. I'm really struck by what seems like amnesia about the importance of the various projects of counter-propaganda at various levels of institutional sponsorship and cogitation. It strikes me that working through that history might be a way to give the current arguments about globalization a kind of greater depth and resonance and allow them to take in some of the rich history of political struggle in other parts of the world during the latter half of the 20th century and so forth. So that's my interest is in broadly trying to joining the kind of effort that scholars like yourself have been so important in, which is to try to globalize media studies, make it more adequate to its international intellectual ambition, but also to think about the place of media studies in relationship to the other disciplines, the other social sciences. And so that's my broad set of concerns, Toby. And again, I know that these are concerns that you've yourself written quite a bit about. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that people, on the one hand, in political science, sociology, and anthropology, and on the other, in communication studies, forget is that apart from commercial dictates, which certainly were big impulses for communication studies, their role in the parthenogenetic project of development based on a
Yes.
fantasy of what the United States' domestic culture and politics and economy were.
Yes.
Absolutely crucial. And I think that's part of what you're getting at, and I think
Right.
extraordinarily important.
I love the Parthenogenesis, for which you would say, if I mean, if I understand you right, it's the inability to acknowledge the interlocutors and co-conspirators in the project of internationalism, which was, of course, conflictual as well as not. And nevertheless, you're saying that there wasn't. There's a difficulty in acknowledging any other actor or any other interests apart from those of the United States itself. And I don't want to turn this into my interviewing you, but that's certainly a good way to put it. That if you look at, for example, UNESCO and the United Na States' relationship to UNESCO, as we know, the United States periodically would pull out of UNESCO, cancel its funding, denounce it very loudly, and the United States media would usually obligingly denounce the rest of the world for being tools of a Soviet plot or whoever was the villain of the moment. And and then, the issue would simply disappear from the front pages of the news. But if you follow the various ins and outs of the United States within UNESCO, it seems as if those times when the US actually stayed in UNESCO, enduring the criticism of the world's majority nations and parlaying with or trying to parlay with other countries about, for example, the demand for a new world international information and communication order, which was made in the late mid to late 70s. Actually, the United States stayed in UNESCO at the time. And, if you compare its behavior at various other points, for example, when UNESCO endorsed the right of Palestine and qualified the rights of Israel, United States pulled out, etc., we have to ask, why did the US stay in when they were subject to such criticism? I mean, as you know, there was once a vote put in the UN General Assembly where every country in the world voted against the proposal mooted by the United States to sanction direct broadcasting by satellites into people's homes. Every country in the world voted against the US, but the US stayed. It didn't walk out. So it seems to me that when the US needed the United Nations as a place where it could claim that it was really trying to engage with the interests of the world's majority, it would actually suck it up and swallow the criticism. But when they didn't need the UN, they would just walk out, denounce it, cut their funding, and watch the UN or its whatever agencies were involved languish from the resulting harm that came to the organization. To quote Jean Patrick, those who have the money don't have the votes, and those who have the votes don't have the money. So that just about summed it up. So yes, the question of why the United States, at least in its stated principles and very often even in its observable politics, has been apparently so solipsistic, which is, I think, the companion word to your term parthenogenesis, it is extraordinary. But in the case of media, it strikes me that, Herbert Schiller's 1975 essay, which you would know well and everybody should know, on the free flow of information being the fundamental principle of US foreign policy right from the start of the Cold War, which essentially came into Schiller's view as late as the mid 1970s. That although it had been in play from the early to mid 1940s, and although the United States had made arguments for imposing the free flow of information as a rule applicable to the world's media repeatedly in closed-door meetings in the UN and so on. Every other country, including its close European allies, resisted because they had experienced European fascism and knew what an irresponsible move that would be. But the US astonishingly stuck with that principle, never walked away from it, and chose not to make it a headline of its foreign policy, but nevertheless retained it as a quiet principle of diplomatic action. And when we see it actually come above ground and become sort of triumphantly announced is towards the very end of the Cold War, when you have the sense that things were going their way and they needed a story to connect the dots and declare the United States triumphant. And the free flow of information was the perfect candidate to suggest that they knew all along exactly where the story was going to end, and it ended, seemingly ended exactly where they predicted. So I think that the solipsism, weird as it is, has a realpolitik which has to be acknowledged as very effective in its own peculiar way, all qualifications attached, that seems to make a narrative coherent and comprehensive of.
No, I hear that, but it does have within it a seed of contradiction in that connected to it is a belief in copyright, a faith in intellectual property,
Yes,
and an
yes.
economic rather than an ideological commitment. So that means that, for example, in some of the closing debates on the general tariff, general agreement on tariffs and trade, the GATT, that then is transformed into today's World Trade Organization. The US, pardon me, under both, well, under the first George Bush, but especially under Bill Clinton, initially is all set for free flow of information understood as connected to copyright on behalf of Hollywood in particular, but is prepared to shift when the sanctity of the Farm Bill and the monumental subvention given to completely inefficient farming sectors in the United States, in contest with places like India and Belgium and Australia and Canada, that can be sacrificed, right?
Right.
At economic level, the
Right.
free flow information slash copyright, with all those contradictions, can be set aside when you get the really big corporate farming lobby with all the money it gives to politicians insisting on that, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So
Yeah.
I do think it's important to think about these things, certainly at the political level, but also the economic one, because they were prepared to dump it, when
Yes. Yeah.
needed.
Right. Yeah. Well, I take your point. I mean, the interesting thing about free flow was that it was you have someone like John Foster Dulles saying in 1945, and he, went on to become Secretary of State, and he was highly influential in shaping Cold War foreign policy. He says in 1945, if I were to be allowed just one point of foreign in a foreign policy agenda, it would be the free flow of information.
Oh, really? I
And
didn't know that.
yes, oh yeah.
That's a
And
great quotation.
yes, and it was because they were confident that no authoritarian government, such as those that they opposed, could survive if they were subject to a barrage of misinformation and disinformation and simply information contrary to whatever they were putting out. And that since the United States dominated the world's media in any case, free flow was sure to benefit them and hurt their enemies. So it was a foreign policy weapon, but was a kind of updating of the old open door policy, which weaponized free trade, but really quite selectively interpreted, as I think you're pointing out, very much so, yes.
And Prof, if we can go back to your earlier statements about being a boy engineer and how this was the thing at your school, I wonder if you could locate that in a Nehruvian idea of development.
Right.
And the
Yes. Yes.
implications of that, moving away from media studies, the
Yeah.
implications of that for India today, for all that investment in institutes of technology, in engineers, and so on. What did that project produce today? What are the lineaments of that, would you say?
Right. Yes. That's a very big question. I mean, yes. Overwhelmingly, a focus on science and technology as the safest ways to catch up with the West. So, this kind of idea that development was essentially about, becoming like them but different from them. It was it could be variously passed. But definitely, questions of the humanities became conceivable as, choices for career and so on for a minority. Really, it was you either had extraordinary privilege, extraordinary belief in yourself, or just a very warped sense of what was going to be possible. There's no question that when I was in college, the very idea of studying English or philosophy, I mean, that was it had loser written all over it, to my mind. Really, it was after coming to the United States on a fellowship to study electrical engineering. Soon after I arrived, I sort of looked around me and I thought, now, really, there's no point in going after money in a place like this. I should do what I want. But then I didn't know what to do because I only knew science and technology. I mean, the word sociology came into my mind. I have no idea why. So one thing led to another, and I ended up with a PhD. But yes, I think the idea that development was about technique and that culture would take care of itself, and that old questions of religion would become utterly irrelevant, that we were now in a post-metaphysical context where the old debates had simply been rendered nugatory. I think that confidence, in retrospect, was misplaced. Yeah.
Well, Arvind, today I was looking back at Weber on the disenchantment of the world. And
Yeah.
how profoundly secular people such as myself read that with great assertive, even arrogant confidence
Yes,
in the
right.
70s and 80s that this would predict the future. And it just hasn't, although admittedly he was talking about magic, which many people have taken to mean religion, and it may not. But the
Yes, right.
profound importance of religion is
Right.
something that really passed me by for
Yeah.
decades, actually.
Right. Yes. And I think someone like Talal Asad, who's pointed out that if you actually look at the meanings attributed to secularism in any given context, they always turn out to be closely related to whatever is defined as religion in that context.
Of course. Yeah.
So it was so contextual that in fact you couldn't transfer the meaning to another context without completely losing changing the meaning of the term. So to give you one example, the separation of church and state, which was an achievement in mono-ethnic, mono-religious European states, which had succeeded in ethnic cleansing and converting their religious minorities and so on. In the colonial context, it meant something totally different because you had diverse populations and so on. So yes, one had to deal with a whole host of questions that sociology didn't necessarily prepare me for, right? Because I was taught that we were now modern and so on. Yeah, so it's not at all that one's education was adequate to the task. But here, I mean, without getting further into question sociological, Since we're talking about media studies, and it's worth talking about cultural studies, which I think is also something that you and I have had a shared interest in, and that arrived at a sort of rupture in the US scene, certainly with its kind of much more positivist focus on media and its conservative tendency, the ways in which it framed questions. And cultural studies seemed terribly interesting, terribly important, very lively and contemporary. But and so I would say that, for I mean, working as I did in sociology, cultural studies, I think what was it showed a way to ask questions which could not easily be framed within the sociological tools that I had available to me at the time, work Stuart Hall and so on, Hard Road to Renewal, Toad in the Garden, basically his work on Thatcherism
Right.
and seeing parallels to that in the Indian context. But by to my surprise, when I published the work which demonstrated the parallels to Thatcherism in India, none of the cultural studies crowd, certainly in the UK and West, maybe yourself, a few people accepted. It was about themselves, and to make these arguments from the so-called third world violated disciplinary boundaries, and while it could be of interest, it didn't find a sort of institutional place to reside and actually catch and allow the debate to grow and so on. So I think there's something there about the persistent and unintended Eurocentrism of cultural studies, which was an innocent abroad and not quite prepared for its, for its being reinterpreted in other contexts.
I think that's all too true and brilliantly put. I wonder if we could move now to speak about two very important books you wrote. One is probably the one you were just referring to, Politics After Television, and the other, The Indian Public Sphere. So, 20 odd years ago, when we were already friends, I read Politics After Television, an astonishing book.
Very kind.
And you were kind enough to explain to me patiently about Hindutva, about RSS. Now, these things are not just regrettable tendencies, they are dominant forces, utterly dominant forces. And some of them, of course, funded by people who did engineering degrees in India. And then, like you, moved to Northern California, but with other desires and contacts, right?
Yes, former classmates included. Yeah, absolutely.
I'll bet, yeah. And I wonder if, because only about 4 or 5% of listeners are in India. About 20% are in the US, about 20% in Britain, about 14% in both Spain and Australia. If you wouldn't mind outlining a bit about how you explained Hindu nationalism all those years ago, 25 years ago, and how you would explain it today, because it's not the Hindu nationalism that I grew up with, which I thought of as part of the Nehruvian compromise and the attempt to produce an equitable and a fair modernity.
The first point that I'll make is that religion had a curious place in the American imagination during the Cold War, simultaneously rendered obsolete by modernization, which no longer required religion because it demonstrated that the afterlife, all the benefits hitherto consigned to the afterlife could be enjoyed in this life itself. And but nevertheless, as the United States opposed the communist superpower in the Cold War, the way to distinguish itself was precisely that God was on our side, and if Soviet Union claimed that history was on their side, well, God was the US ally, so to say. And so there was a kind of backstage endorsement of religion, which was not perhaps not so backstage. No president could hope to become president without copious demonstration of their, devout Christian attitude and so on. Maybe we can think about foreign policy, maybe we can think about domestic politics, the way in which questions of religion were tended to be sidelined in the dominant modes of reportage. So it could be front stage when convenient, it could be backstage when necessary. It was a slippery category. Yeah. And perhaps we can say that the turning point was the Iranian Revolution, when it was demonstrated that religion wasn't simply a private entity, could be a dangerous, radical, revolutionary entity. And it's probably thereafter that the US began to fund the jihadis in Afghanistan, and in general, understand that religion could be a very reliable counter-revolutionary force. So that's one point. The second is that within the Indian context, yes, certainly the Nehruvian secular dispensation also it never thought of Hindutva as belonging to the past. That was certainly not Nehru's idea. He was constantly warning against its ever-present danger. But I think for people like myself, those educated in the wake of Nehruvianism, very much assumed that secularism was a fait accompli in some sense. And we have to note that even Hindutva, the votaries of the Hindu nationalist groups themselves, assumed that it was not going to be possible to capture power in any time soon, and that even if they sought to do so, it was incumbent upon them to avoid overtly Hindu symbolism, because the Hindu religion is so diverse and so variegated that any use of Hindu deities, actual Hindu ritual and symbols, would be sure to divide their population and not unite it. And therefore, what was required was a new Hindu symbol, which was what the Hindu nationalists themselves invented and proposed, a saffron flag, and that would represent the living Hindu nation, etc. So now, to their surprise, and this is the sort of communicational event that was at the heart of my story, the process of discovering that India was not secular at all in the way that it had been understood, and that in fact living Hindu symbols and rituals could work just fine, thank you, to aggregate hitherto unthinkable numbers of people. The broadcast of Hindu epics in the late 80s showed that there was an opportunity here which the Hindu right itself had not noticed until it was literally thrust in their face. And so they built upon the popularity of the Hindu epics broadcast by their own opposition government, whom they derided as secular, and to cut a long story short, climbed to power through that route. So that's what we have today. So one can see basically two phases of Hindutva. One is when the BJP and the RSS were in the opposition. And we're in the second phase now, when they are actually in power and they are laying the groundwork for a 1,000-year Reich. So that's a broad division between, so you know, two phases. They're really now assuming that they are going to be unshakable, you know, and certainly with an 83% Hindu majority, they're in good shape to plans of that kind.
And if we go back to development studies, where we started, in a sense, this conversation, Arvind, one of the donnée of that, and one of the nostra that Indian developmentalists and governmental officials were worried about, was that there was something at the core of Hinduism that precluded development. And this had elements that associated with passivity and failure of masculinity connected with it.
Among other things, yes, absolutely.
And one of the elements of the RSS, the non-government organization of the Hindu right and Hindutva's beliefs, is quite macho, no? One of the beliefs.
Very much so. Very much so. Yes, I mean the uniform of the RSS, the for many decades, was exactly that of the British colonial policeman, the colonial police officer of the British Raj, khaki shorts and white shirt and leather boots and so on. So yes, they very much modeled themselves on secular lines, you should say, what one should say. And Ashish Nandi has made this point that nobody's more secular, he used to say, than the Hindu right. They would never go.
I haven't seen that writing, but he's a great writer.
But I mean, even in my field work, I did field work in Ayodhya around the Ram Temple, which is now, you know, recently been inaugurated at great expense and declared a national symbol and so on. The RSS would never actually worship at the Ram Temple. It was the hoi polloi that would do that. They were simply,
Oh, how interesting.
So yes, the question of whether Hinduism was a religion at all was debated, right? Because it seemed to be something beneath, it didn't quite reach the bar, right? So it didn't have, it doesn't have a single book, it doesn't have a single god, it doesn't have a single, you know, a quarter of the people don't aren't even allowed to worship at the temples, you know, because they're deemed untouchable or unseeable. So yes, it's if it's a religion, there's no other religion like it, we have to say. So, you know, and I think the general sort of attitude of charity towards the third world that sort of came upon the West in the second post World War II period. It was in that context that this kind of revisionism began to take place, where every nation was allowed its culture and religion, and so Hinduism rose to that status. And probably here we would have to say that the diaspora has been important in advancing the claims of Hinduism to being on an equal status with the world's great religions and so
Religions.
forth.
Of course, one of the things also for the US was that it was long suspicious of Nehru's socialistic tendencies. And
Yes, that's right. Now, Arthur Schlesinger, who was a intimate of John F. Kennedy, you know, he has this, you know, he wrote, I think, in the late 40s that that Nehru was a reliable anti-communist as far as U.S. interests were concerned, that, you know, United States didn't really have to worry about it, even though they were obviously anxious not to annoy Soviet Union and to try to maintain some parity in India's relationships with the two superpowers. And it seems to me that that kind of view probably was more influential than maybe some of the accounts of US foreign policy lead us to believe. So, for example, when in 1975, when India Well, India, the Prime Minister was Indira Gandhi, and she declared a national emergency, suspended civil liberties, arrested, all the opposition leaders, and generally demonstrated that democracy was an option. It wasn't a compulsion in the Indian case. The United States really refrained from condemnation, sanctions. It went very, very light. It really took great pains not to offend India at the time. Now, that could suggest that they were apprehensive, but it also suggests a limit to their suspicions and a sense that, this was going to be a manageable issue. And let's remember, of course, a few years before that, Indira Gandhi signed a friendship treaty with the Soviet Union in 1972, before she launched a war in Pakistan, whose army was occupying Bangladesh at the time. And let's recall, Kissinger and the US in general favored Pakistan at the time.
Oh, and I mean, one of its great geopolitical mistakes was that after the end of the Soviet Empire, it dropped Pakistan completely,
Yes.
having favored it in many ways for so long. And
Yes.
this is one of the
Right.
hidden elements of what happens with the Taliban, that
Yeah.
and the whole support for Imran Khan now is that some
Yeah.
of this is because the US, as is so often the case with the so-called great powers, was in fact engaged in brutal self-interest and
Oh, yes. Yeah.
had minimal, if any, commitment to the ideals that it was espousing, right?
That's right. Yeah. So yes, I mean, I think the Samuel Huntington wrote an essay in the mid 1970s where he makes this contrast between the US style of international engagement, which is always at a distance, didn't demand territorial control, was satisfied with access to markets, that it represented such a different kind of engagement with colonial territories, or overseas territories, because it was characterized by so much more ignorance of who and what they were dealing with, that it posed questions that of great concern about the outcome of such engagement. And I think, yes, what you're saying is right. We do see the results of that kind of distant and distracted form of engagement, which seems to be so many instances that we
And
can.
so, and that's a warning for China, which has clearly based its imperialism not on the classic European model of occupation, but on the influence at a distance model of the US. But getting back to your books, Prof, Politics After Television from 2001 and The Indian Public Sphere from 2009.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I'd like to say a word more about the politics after television, which is that the consensus in the scholarship at the time was generally that that the RSS, which was this paramilitary outfit, which styled itself on the brown shirts and idolized Mussolini and Hitler and so on. That it had not changed from the day it was founded, the year 1925, to the late 1990s, that it was exactly the same, that it was something, a closed entity outside history, essentially. And this tendency of treating Hindu nationalism as outside the stream of historical developments was a convenient way to maintain the secular national narrative, which is, I think, generally what the scholarship tended to try to do. And because that scholarship was dominated by colonial historians reading the colonial archive, they could stick with that narrative. Well, they did stick with that narrative. And But because as a sociologist, I looked at contemporary sources and drawing on, because I had been exposed to cultural studies, I was interested in quote unquote media, which was a degraded object as far as the archivists were concerned, not quite worth their attention. I was able to uncover something that I think the standard scholarship missed, which was that Hindu nationalism was, surprise, surprise, a historical entity. It was changing in response to historical currents, and that in fact they had gained the advantage over the secular government in their success in mobilizing people and so forth. Yeah, so, and one additional thing I'll say is that, of course, television was very important, but the way it worked through a language-divided press, the English media and the vernacular media, that the historical misunderstandings between a colonial language of command and the vernacular languages that the Indians used, those misunderstandings proved to be crucial in enabling Hindu nationalism's success. Yeah, so yeah, so that's the there've been a few books on that subject, of course, but a senior Indian bureaucrat, Secretary of Culture, wrote an op-ed recently where he remarked how little work actually Indian scholars have done that explained the rise to power of the BJP. Although there are so many scholars around, that it's a relatively uninterrogated, unanalyzed subject. So I think some attention to it is useful, to try to also to explain why is it that, the most momentous if event of the past few decades and has actually been there are so few attempts that actually try to understand how it arose.
So, Prof, unfortunately, we've only got about 3 minutes left.
Yeah,
I
all right.
wonder if in those 2 or 3 minutes there are things we haven't yet discussed that you would like to bring to our attention.
Yeah, well, I'll just say one thing perhaps, which is the something that I already said. Maybe worth repeating, which is that the idea of media is it's we had a discipline, the birth of a discipline, media studies, whose extraordinary achievement was actually to degrade the concept and to evacuate it of any interesting contribution to the other social sciences, and instead to reassure their political masters that they would say nothing that would rock the boat. And I think we're still, maybe we're past that legacy, but I don't think it's altogether past. I think there is still a sense of disreputability, or sort of we don't know quite where you've been and what you're up to, if you're doing this kind of media stuff and it's not quite, up to scratch and so forth. So I think the you don't actually find successful disciplines prominent in the academy in terms of recruitment and placement and so forth that are have such a strikingly different intellectual profile vis-a-vis other disciplines, because the work of this discipline was one of negation rather than, positive contribution, if you like. I mean, that's one way to put it. Yeah.
Well,
So.
I can't wait to read your next book, which will be no doubt born of the fruits of this labor.
Very
It's
good.
always
Thank you.
wonderful to speak to you. I always learn so much. There's always more to learn from you, and it's been great chatting.
Thank you so much, Toby. Look forward to catching up soon, and thank you for including me in your interview.